Right, so hello and welcome to another Future Pharmacist Conference session. So a topic close to my heart, this one tonight, and we have, we're joined. The beauty of this online scene, although everyone is a little bit zoomed out, I guess, but the beauty of it is that we can get a very, very disparate, geographically disparate group people on the call and have a bit of a chat, and we've got some very good friends and colleagues of PIP from various professional backgrounds on the call tonight. So it's I will leave them to introduce themselves. But the title of this session is "So Are Patient Group Directions Holding Pharmacists Back?" Now, I know there's some people in pharmacy will get quite excited and quite possibly even borderline upset at that statement, for various reasons. PGDs have been around for some years, and this whole sort of chat is going to hopefully explore where they've come from. Are they any good? What's the point? We've got guests from around the country with various perspectives and different practice settings use PGDs, and different countries use PGDs in pharmacy in different ways. So without further ado, because there's quite a few people on the call, I'm gonna start with Derek. And Derek, let's just go around the houses, and Derek, Farzana, Sid, and then Harry, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, and just a few lines about, I think as Roy Walker would say, what's your name and where do you come from, basically?
Okay, thanks, Jonathan. My name's Derek Evans. I am an independent prescriber. I've been on the pharmaceutical register for 38 years now. So here we go. I've seen a lot of things come and change, and I took up independent prescribing well over 10 years ago. And I now run an independent pharmacy consultancy in the speciality of travel and tropical medicine. And from that, I run a series of support services and medical on-call services to supply the backup services that are needed for PGD supply, and it right across the professions, including nurses, pharmacists, and also some doctors as I'm a specialist in that field. So my opinion about PGDs is I think we need to move forward, and I think the PGDs have now become victims of their own success, and I think we need to consider the movement forward, and perhaps I'll enter that into those points into the debate further on, but I'll pass on now to Farzana.
Thank you, Derek. So I am Farzana Hack. I'm a practice pharmacist in Fife, Scotland. I'm also an active independent prescriber. I've been a prescriber for 4 years. Throughout my 16-year career, I've always kept a hand in community pharmacy, mainly as a locum. I've never had the opportunity to actually prescribe in community, so I see how PGDs do have a place. So we provide consistent services to patients, but how do we move on from that? So I'm interested in having this debate with my fellow participants today.
Hi all, my name is Siddiq Rahman. I'm a GP practice-based pharmacist prescriber working in Kent in England. I've been working as a prescriber for the last 4 years, specialising in type 2 diabetes and hypertension. I still have an active role working in community pharmacy settings. So I'm a local pharmacist during some of the weekends. And prior to my role in general practice about 5 years ago, I've been a full-time local community pharmacist for the best part of a decade. And prior to that, I was a pharmacy manager at a national multiple chain And I've experienced using PGDs as well for certain PMed and PomMed as well. So now I'm actually looking forward to this discussion as well, because I know prescribing is going to become quite a controversial topic as well over the next coming weeks, months and years, as the new GPAC training standards are being changed to enable all pharmacy students to become a prescriber or prescriber ready from day one of qualification. Thank you, and over to Harry.
So thanks for that, and good evening, colleagues. Harry McQuillan, I'm currently, I suppose, title Chief Executive Community Pharmacy Scotland, and Jonathan's probably picked me because I am not an independent prescriber. But what I am, I have a firm view about where I think the future of that goes. In terms of my patient group direction or PGD experience, 17 years or now since I was the first pharmacist to put my name to the urgent supply PGD in Scotland, and we still use that, etc. So it's, I think it has its uses. And I'm sure we'll discuss what the future of PGD could be, and as Sid says, how that links rather nicely or not to the new GPHC standards.
Thank you very much, everyone. So with all these sessions, there's it's our conference. I run pharmacy and practice, so the joy of that is that I can pick. Yeah, I can pick the teams this time. Maybe next time we'll have an editorial board or something, but I just thought we've got to get going, and why not? I would just pick my own teams and go from there. You sort of all shared a little bit about your background, and yeah, Harry, for once I've picked you for something you're not. So you're not an independent prescriber. I think I'll just go around the houses and just share, and then I'm gonna tee up a question based on my recent chat with our new Chief Pharmaceutical Officer in Scotland, Alison Strass. So Harry, you've obviously got, you know, spectacular experience and knowledge at policy level. You've been a practicing pharmacist over the years, and you've had various management roles in Boots and other places. But you're of interest to me because you're that cohort of pharmacists that will not qualify as an independent prescriber. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I think you know you've done amazing work. You've come from community pharmacy, as far as I understand, and you've really taken that step. Well, not step, like multiple steps and running towards advanced practice, as far as I understand. And you know, the stuff you're involved in now from a prescribing perspective, in my opinion, very impressive. And yeah, so great to have your experience and expertise on this, and to discuss what your view is. Farzana, very similar. You know, your heart, I can tell your heart is in community pharmacy, like many of us. That's absolutely fine. You just can't give it up. It's very annoying. That's how I feel about it sometimes. But I think we share that common thread that community pharmacy is where maybe prescribing could be best deployed. Maybe. And then finally, Derek, you're in, and don't take this the wrong way, but in many ways you're an outlier, because you actually run a private, as you described more comprehensively than I could, I'll probably fluff it, but you know, you run this private vaccination clinic. So that's standalone private clinical services. And you know, I know from speaking to you that you have to deal with the Care Quality Commission, and I think your insights in this conversation could be very interesting around the regulatory side of all of this, and where the GPHC are now, where maybe they might go with all these education and training standard things coming in, but also what's the mechanism for, you know, Joe Bloggs pharmacist to take that step away from PGDs and become a prescriber. So something I hope I quote her right, because I haven't listened back to the recording, but Alison Strath was very kind to give me some time as part of this conference, and we did an interview, which by the time I publish this recording will be live. But what she said was PGDs are a little bit like having L plates on.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the question to kick this chat off is really, Do you agree with that? Are we in danger of giving PGDs too hard a time? So, you know, just to open it up, I'd really like to just to get your view on where PGDs have come from, where we are now, and you know where you see it going in the future, really. And we're we decided before the call we'd use our manual hand, our actual hands, instead of the hand up function, because none of us can work go-to meetings. So if someone wants to raise their hand to go first, that would be absolutely magic. Harry, go for it.
Jonathan, I think it's a very good analogy. And if I'm right, maybe Derek and me might remember the introduction of PGDs back post the Crown Review and where they actually came and the whole thing about non-medical prescribing, but actually became a supply function rather than a prescribing function. And I think that's a really important distinction about the use of a PGD, because it really is, it's for a supply function. Whereas, as we know, we take it into the clinical aspect of prescribing. So but what it does do for me, it gets the profession and individuals in a position to at least consider it. Because in the main, the PGD requires patient prescription-only medications and how you're actually going to use them. So it gets you used to the consultation and then probably the supply of more complex medicines than you traditionally can do over-the-counter in a community pharmacy. So it just helps take that first step. And like everything else, when you then do qualify as a driver, you dispense with the L plates. And actually, you start to learn to drive once you've passed your test. And that's where I think the profession's going with prescribing. And I have to say, I'm an advocate of that. I think the future definitely lies for me, for the profession, in prescribing and how that links to the wider team. So it's not about being separatist in it. It's about being inclusive and taking your role in primary care and patient care. So I think it's a very useful analogy, and I'll let other colleagues come in.
Derek's got his hand up there. Go for it, Derek.
Okay. As I said, my experience is slightly different because I speak to not just the pharmacist, but I speak to other professions as well. And the view of PGDs I'm getting from the feedback is that, as Harry said, when they initially came in, it was a supply function. It was quite tight. But now pharmacy has developed. We have developed a much more clinical role. We know that we have people in there. We have people, you know, PCNs, we have people working in GP practices. And I believe now we are moving forward. Does the PGD, because it's easy to use, you've got everything written down, and pharmacists rely on that rather than using a lot of their clinical knowledge. And I'm finding now that people are using that but not actually developing themselves beyond the PGD clinically. And I think as we carry on down this road, we are going to start entering into a position where people are not going to be developing themselves or their clinical skills because this is an easy option.
Farzana, you're next, and then Sid as well coming in after.
Thank you, Jonathan. I very much agree with what Alex just said. So there are a number of services in Scotland that could easily be done by an independent prescriber, but much of the POM services available as part of the core Scottish contract do rely on Scottish pharmacists signing the PGDs rather than using an IP qualification, even if they have one. And while it's great that in Scotland the IPs can prescribe under the NHS Pharmacy First Plus for a range of acute common clinical conditions, community pharmacies have to apply to their local boards first to be provided with NHS prescription pads in order to provide the service, as well as be allocated a prescriber code. There's extra requirements such as the NESS consultation and core clinical skills, as well as the common clinical conditions training. Now, I've done all that training, but yet I don't have the opportunity to prescribe in community as a locum because of the way it's set up. So really, when you are applying for a pad from your NHS board, what budget is that going to come out of? And really, I think at the moment, the service is more set up for employed pharmacists in Scotland, and the locum network is the workforce. It's a large part of the community network, and they're underutilized. And so I think there's a number of reasons people are sticking to PGDs, and how are they going to move on and progress? Even if you have done all that training and you feel more competent to assess, prescribe, diagnose, but there isn't the framework there currently.
Mm-hmm. I see Harry nodding there, and I think I'll let Harry come in. Do you want to respond, Harry? Then we'll go to
sure. The aspect of part of my role is to look at tomorrow and not today. And as we look at this, and we've already said, the General Pharmaceutical Council has changed the goalposts. The world has changed from when those PGDs came in and the practice that Farzana has just described. And therefore, as a result in Scotland, we are on a strategy and a trajectory to introduce at least one independent prescriber in every community pharmacy in the network. So actually, there will have to be a change in practice. We understand that, but that's coming. I mean, I agree, it's not there today, and actually, in many ways, it's set up in that particular manner. But actually, in the future, you see how that has to link. We need better access to pads. In fact, do we need pads? Well, that's the first question. You know, and how that digitization goes. It's not about that. It's about how we look at individuals and how they can be accountable for their practice. So I agree with that. That's where it is today. It can't be there tomorrow. And when I say tomorrow, we're talking 5-6 years' time as those graduates come in. So we're acutely aware of that, particularly as I talk about for Scotland. So during that interim period, we're still going to need PGD. We're going to need a process that allows and equips the people like me, or the mid-career people who have not been exposed to the IP training and opportunities that others have, to get them over that bridge. So that I'm sure is coming. So I don't disagree with where we are today. It won't be where we are tomorrow.
Thanks, Harry. Sid?
Well, first of all, I just got to say, as the only English pharmacist on the panel, that the model in Scotland are way ahead of England in terms of both the Pharmacy First and the Pharmacy First Plus scheme, because they do a more range of conditions for even for PGD level as well as the IPs in the community pharmacy setting. I mean, we're talking about working in the community pharmacy setting for those future in the prescribers. When Jonathan first asked me about this debate about whether PGDs are they going to become obsolete as we're getting more prescribers onto the scene, and, you know, and my first impression was, you know, that's pretty obvious. You know, it's pretty much an open shut case. But the more I look into it, and the more I speak to current community pharmacists, and also my role as a PDA union rep for primary care, I realise that even those newly qualified prescribers, regardless of how long they've been working in pharmacy, they're still not yet fully confident to be delivering medication under prescribing, and they feel more confident doing it under the PGD. And what the PGD offers compared to prescribing at the moment is that they've got this governance structure, protocols, SOPs in place. And they've got like a fail-safe, similar to what Derek was saying early on. And I've recently chaired a meeting at the pharmacy show with a private clinic, and they offer various private PGDs for community pharmacies. And then I asked a question to one of the clinician leaders to say, you know, if we are going to get more and more prescribers into community pharmacy, will that make PGDs obsolete? And they said there's still a long time before we even see that happening, because of the structure and governance that's been around for years at PGD compared to when you're a prescriber. And I think having that fail-safe as an option when using PGD compared to a prescriber is one we need to discuss going forward.
Thank you very much, Sid. Yeah, and yeah, well, Scotland's Thanks to Harry and colleagues and just a collegiate approach over the years, I guess, which doesn't come easily, as I'm sure Harry will tell you after the meeting. But we are where we are, and we're very lucky we've got an opportunity with Pharmacy First. Derek, you had your hand up.
Yeah, supporting my colleagues and just putting a little bit into the mix. So Harry was rightly picking up the fact that in 5 years' time we'll have newly qualified pharmacists coming out, and we'll have a cohort of people who are time served, very very much experienced. Now, do we grandfather these people into IP? If so, do we use a process like micro-credentialing? And that's really the platform which we want to consider, is how we can give those people the opportunity with their clinical experience and then put them through a process that is not, which allows them to prescribe. And I think micro-credentialing is something that we can really get on board with. My thinking about the legislation, my understanding is there's a current review by the Privy Council over the regulation, certainly in England, because we have the CQC, and in Wales, where I am, that will extend down into the Welsh services as well. And the Privy Council know and realise that when CQC, that's the Care Quality Commission, was set up in the early 2000s, pharmacy was excluded under a clause because it had its own independent inspectorate. At that time, pharmacists, we were dispensing prescription because that was our supply function, and we hadn't even started flu vaccination because that went to the nurses originally, and pharmacists were excluded from that service. Bring us forward now 20 years nearly, and look how far we as a profession have advanced ourselves at lightning speed compared to a lot of the other professions, but the legislation hasn't changed with it. And there was a consultation paper earlier this year which came out from the department, looking from the health services authorities, linking to the Privy Council. And if you start reading between the lines, I believe there is going to be a review of that, so that all the regulatory bodies, including the dentists, the medics, the physiotherapists, and the pharmacists and the nurses, will now come together under one broad umbrella with one regulatory body, something like the CQC or a phoenix from the ashes of the CQC, which will supply the same sets of regulations, whether they be PGD or prescribers, across all professions equally. Now, as a specialist in the field of travel medicine, which is private, I have clients who are regulated by CQC, and yet pharmacy is not regulated, yet they can supply the same services. And we have a different set of standards. Now, for any profession, we know that interprofessional working and education and training is going to be the way forward for the future. We've got to start thinking that we need to have the same equivalent standards. And I think before long, the politicians will get on board with that. I don't know what it would be like in Scotland there, Harry, but certainly I've seen this document come down, and reading between the lines, I suspect something is under review.
All right.
It's an interesting point, Derek, and certainly for us, if I'm still right, if we get the right terminology right, it's Health Improvement Scotland up here that will look after that, or and Laura and our team that come in and do that, and they face exactly the same, and we use the phrase loophole, as you do down south of the CQC. What I think there's also, because PGDs for me will still exist amongst other professions who are not going down the prescriber route in terms of the regulatory practice, so the paramedics of our colleagues, I know some of them can still be prescribers yet, but in the majority, they're going to supply under a PGD. So I think we're going to have a mixed economy. In terms of the question for the PGDs for our profession, I see them taking a back seat. Because that's where, but therefore, and as yet, as they still stand, you still have to have a pharmacist sign your PGD. I don't think that will change in the immediate future. So those will stay. So there'll still be some pharmaceutical input to the actual application and structure of the patient group direction and supply by some of our other quality professionals. But for us, I still don't see them as being the linchpin of the services going forward, because we need something for them to do. I think Farzana very eloquently put, how do you actually then make that available across the community setting and where we actually go? And that's why I have to say, credit to my board, was my thinking about, we need a service in the community that people can use their skills that they're going to be coming out with. Hence, we've taken an early approach to need to introduce something and actually can go as far as, say, incentivize people to use those skills. Because it's a behavioral change we're looking for. It's not actually a clinical change, well, in some respects, a clinical change, but we're looking for the behavioral change. So that's where I see that coming forward, because we know in 5 years' time, as we've mentioned, the goalposts are changing, the workforce is changing, and we need something for them to do. And that may be some of the reticence I hear from Sid and some of the other colleagues, well, why do we let them go? Because actually, it may be because we don't have anything for them to do. And we've got an opinion up here that actually we need to turn our mind to that now, because we know there's a new landscape coming.
Very interesting points. Farzana.
I just wanted to ask, how do we encourage those who are currently active independent prescribers providing the, for example, the Pharmacy First Plus service in Scotland, to actually step away from almost hiding behind some of the PGDs at the moment? So I've seen it in practice. I've had patients being referred to the practice that I work in because the pharmacist assessed on a patient, say a female patient, for the UTI service with PGD, but yet they provide the Pharmacy First Plus service. So they've used the exclusion criteria on the PGD to refer those patients to the GP. But and then I have the GP coming to me and querying, why have these patients been sent to us? Because there's no red flags. And certainly I know these patients are supposed to assess and manage these acute symptoms using their IP skills and not just do the tick box exercise. So how do we move on from that in the next couple of years before we have this new cohort of prescribers coming out of their university course in 5 years' time? How do we get the IPs currently actively prescribing to step away from the PGDs?
I'll come to Sid in a second and then Derek. But I want to say something. Farzana, I think you've hit the nub of this. That is where I'm going with this. Hopefully I'm safe enough picking a fight with PGDs, because and let's not be too hard on them, because yeah. I think Derek mentioned the flu vaccine stuff. Now, Harry, you could correct me here, but I think Charles Mickey in Aberdeen was one of the first flu vaccination clinics in the UK, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. So let's be honest, back then, whenever that was, 90s, late night, I'm not sure. 20 years ago, whatever, doesn't matter. That was quite revolutionary, wasn't it? And Derek, your input about the regulatory side of that and how the CQC, there's an exemption, all that stuff, very interesting and relevant. But Farzana, you've hit the nail on the head. And are we now at a point, I mean, that's just for the rest of the conversation, that is the point of this conversation. So are we at a point now, you know, is the net gain from that sort of supply PGD function or a bit of legislation, are we now losing ground on the potential? And I would suggest possibly we are in some quarters. Sid and Farzana in their practice are, flying ahead with what they're doing. And Farzana, just to address, before I come to Sid, just to address your point, one of the first prescriptions I wrote in community pharmacy was for hydrocortisone 1% for a 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my hand was shaking, you know, but I mean, really, come on. As a more experienced prescriber now, I'm thinking, really, that's totally appropriate. I think it was X, Marcel, I can't remember what it was, but anyway, it doesn't matter. But I mean maybe we'll come back to this later on in the conversation, but I bet you a fiver, Harry, and more from a network perspective, maybe would have concerns around consistency of delivery. So what I wouldn't want happening is if there's a Pharmacy First Plus service and a young lady comes in with a simple, uncomplicated UTI, dead easy to differentially diagnose. If they're outside the age range by a few months or a year or so, what we don't we do not want that person to be sent to the GP practice, because the GP is just going to be like, what, really? Anyway, that's me off my soapbox. Sid.
Well, what I was going to say, again, it could be different in Scotland compared to England, but I think in terms of prescribing, especially within a community pharmacy setting, is to be sort of self-prescribers. And I think indemnity might play a part in it as well, because whenever you sign a prescription, you know, you are, it's not just about quick and easy access of medication for patients. You, as a clinician, you're going to be fully accountable and responsible for that patient that you see in front of you. And any diagnosis and treatment you give will be on you. And so you obviously need to be confident and competent to do so. I don't think in community pharmacy we're great at recording or documenting compared to hospitals and general practices. Again, whether that could be a barrier, whether it's a training needs for that as well. Again, I'm not sure if this is illegal or where it's frowned upon is giving or prescribing medication in the community pharmacy setting and then also dispensing it as well in the same pharmacy, especially if you're the only pharmacist as well. So again, there might be contentious issues with that going forward. So I think hopefully Harry will be able to discuss more on that issue.
Thanks, Sid. I'll go to Harry briefly to come back to Sid's point, and then Derek was wanting to come in.
Yeah. So just the thing with that, Sid, we've also thought about that, and there's an aspect there, both myself and Derek, you see we're sitting wearing glasses, and there's already a process out there by our optometry colleagues. I have yet to meet someone who gets their glasses prescribed at an optician's to take it somewhere else to get them dispensed. There actually is a model out there that does that. And it's only our own profession that thinks it's not a good idea. So, but I accept that the risk that goes with it, when actually that's when we should have the appropriate team and the appropriate IT and technical ability behind us to do the technical side of that supply. So I think there is a route and there's a combination that allows it to happen, to allow you as an individual, as a professional, to use your true, what I think you're trained for, and that is the intervention, the clinical aspect of making sure the supply is appropriate, and being involved in the supply, using your team and using the technology to make sure it's done as accurate as we can. So I think there is a model there for us through there. And yes, you can say it's a risk. Everything's a risk. But I genuinely think it can be managed. So I thought that was a useful thing for at least to consider when it came up.
Derek.
Yeah, just really to follow on with what Harry and Sid have said, and also in response to the very valid points that Faz has just raised, there is actually a document out there saying when PGDs are not required. That's the title, and it's written by the NHS. It's in their specialist pharmacy service. And point 3 on that says situations where a PGD should not be used. And it lists them, that says where the care pathway for the medicine to be safely prescribed on an individual basis by a prescriber and the majority of clinical areas should be undertaken. And they suggest PSD supply, writing prescriptions. And then we come into what Harry says about having IT systems. They actually say completion of pre-printed parts of a drug chart. Okay, we've seen it in hospitals already. They also suggest entry on electronic prescribing and medicines administration systems. This is already documented and listed on the NHS. And then they go on to the next point and say there are organisations need to ensure that PGDs are removed from practice in accordance with local governance and changes are robustly communicated to all relevant personnel. So one of the things I see is a proliferation of lots of different PGDs. That's fine. They may be relevant to local communities and they may be relevant. I do see a lot of these PGDs can be a dozen pages, 20 pages long, and if they're updated every year, and they're in, certainly in travel medicine where I am, some of my clients may have 40 to 45 of these. Pharmacists need to have easier access to the legislation. They need to read it and update themselves and sign this off. And it is becoming a laborious process and to keep that robustness. If we're talking about indemnity, if they haven't read the PGD correctly and signed it off and dated it, then they are liable should an error have occurred. Now, personally, as a prescriber, I think they are better to prescribe that product than misread or not have read the PGD, because as a prescriber, your mind is geared up on that clinical robustness and taking each individual patient. So I think, from my mind, there is a possibility. There is already a paper out there which is suggesting through the NHS exactly what we've been saying. And I think, going back to my very earlier comment, I'm questioning whether PGDs are now run their remarkable value.
Very interesting. Thank you, Derek. I'm gonna throw a curveball in, because I do I'm enjoying where the conversation is going. So it's, you know, it's a progressive agenda, isn't it? It's a let's not bin PGDs altogether. We're not daft. You know, we're realistic here. Things take time, and we need consistency of delivery of service. That's a given. But there's nothing wrong with, in my opinion anyway, of working hard at a progressive agenda, and not least through, you know, Pharmacy First in Scotland. But a couple of words I've written down. The first one I've written down is pharmacy technicians. So pharmacy technicians. So my opinion is, for what it's worth, who cares? That I think doing PGDs is a technical task. So actually delivering a PGD could be seen in some quarters, including my quarter, as a technical task. So for the sake of discussion in a convivial environment, we love pharmacy technicians. Should pharmacy technicians be delivering patient group directions? And I suppose the forerunner question to that is, you know, to tee that up, is are PGDs actually a technical task, where really we outsource the responsibility? Farzana.
Thanks, Jonathan. I would agree with that. There's been many a time that when I've been working with a really competent technician and there's so many demands on my time as a community pharmacist, I feel I wish I could have delegated certain tasks to my technician. And without a doubt, there are some technicians I would trust completely to follow a PGD to the very letter. And I know they would not hesitate to be clear where their boundaries are, and they would come and discuss with me if they had any concerns. So I definitely think that technicians are able to follow a PGD and should be given that right to. And I do feel that the PGDs can become a technical checkbox exercise. Don't get me wrong, there's lots of newly qualified pharmacists I speak to who say that the PGDs are a great way for them to build up some sort of scope of practice and just get competent at providing POM under a clinical service. But at the same time, it's important to remember that under the Human Medicines Regulations, pharmacist IPs are seen equivalent to dentists and doctors as appropriate practitioners. And as such, we need to take that forward. And every time we just choose to stick to a PGD, a legal framework, those are there for non-appropriate practitioners. So we're stopping ourselves from moving on.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Interesting thoughts. I would tend to agree. Anyone else got any thoughts? Harry?
I think, for that, I would agree. And I don't think that's the fault of the PGD. That takes us into a professional practice question, which I think is a slightly different area from the PGD. And what I could see is, if we take us again a decade further forward, when we look at the prescribing qualifications of our profession, with and then the technicians there, wouldn't it be great having a PGD infrastructure that technicians could use? But when we stepped outside that framework, you refer to the prescriber, who is, as you say, in parity of esteem with our dentists and medical colleagues, that then intervenes and, you know, uses that prescribing knowledge about, well, just outside this scope. Orzana, so could you please have a look at this, because you have the expertise to consider that on a wider basis. What a lovely infrastructure.
So
I could see how that could fit nicely. So I suppose what I'm saying in terms of a prescribing practice, maybe I need to even reflect on what I said earlier. From a prescribing practice, from a pharmacist perspective, I agree with Derek. I don't think the future is great for PGDs, for a pharmacist, for a technician workforce, and the pharmacy team at its widest. They may actually provide us with some of the resource to allow the pharmacist to do these services, as I see, that become prescribing aspects of the future.
And I suppose what one, I'll come to you in a second, Sid, but one thought off the back of your comments there, Harry, is I think politically there will be maybe pharmacists listening or watching this that, you know, community pharmacy is tough, right? We're talking about abstract things here. It's, you know, we've got to pull it back to reality to a certain degree. And, you know, I know locum rates have improved recently, but, you know, you could argue about, you know, working conditions. And we're not daft. None of us are daft, right? So we're all realistic, and it's tough. But I think in my, and welcome others' thoughts, but I think in my view, probably there would be quite a large cohort of pharmacists that feel threatened by that proposition. But I'm an optimist. I'm absolutely an optimist. And as a pharmacist, I'd back myself. And I think we'll come on maybe to speak about what needs to change to maybe move things on practice-wise, particularly in community pharmacy. But I wonder, would that be one of a few sort of levers that could be pulled to push the workforce forward and actually get these prescribers that are going to come out qualified to actually prescribe? Because we know from old GPHC surveys that, I think probably well out of date, but like 2015 GPHC survey, and only 7% of pharmacist prescribers wrote a prescription within the first 12 months. So I just thought I'd throw that in. Sid, you've been very patient. Thank you.
No, that's okay. It's all pertinent points to make in all. That if you're going back to the use of technicians and PGDs in a community pharmacy setting specifically, I can see that definitely for like flu vaccinations, for example. And again, it's the increased workload at the moment for community pharmacies. And for me, where I visit community pharmacies, especially with the potential new pharmacy prescribers coming to the scene, because at the end of the day, majority of pharmacists will still be working in community pharmacy out of all the sectors in pharmacy at the moment. Where I visit community pharmacy in the future is to, especially for busy pharmacies, is to have a two pharmacists per pharmacy policy. So one maintains the as an RP, making the safe and effective running of the dispensary and the pharmacy, and the second potential pharmacist to be involved in the clinical services aspect and including prescribing. In terms of pharmacy technician prescribing using the PGD for POM medication, especially if any harm comes to that patient, then the question would arise: will the pharmacy technician take full responsibility and liability, or will the RP, responsible pharmacist, will take some portion of the blame or not? And if that's the case, then me as a RP, I wouldn't then feel confident letting not just a pharmacy technician or any other clinician within a pharmacy setting to be given that medication under PGD if I'm still be held liable for that part.
There, great points, Sid. You're asking the right questions. You're delving into the right areas. Regulation of pharmacists and pharmacy technicians and the effectiveness of a GPHC is a whole other thing. Probably a whole other meeting. But I think you're absolutely right. Who carries the can? You know, Derek.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about pharmacists coming out from university. After 5 years with an IP IP status and a legality to be able to write a prescription. What we need perhaps to take a step back is looking at our colleagues in academia at the schools of pharmacy and the lecturers and saying, how do we prepare them to prepare prescribers accurately with confidence so that they can come out on day one and have that confidence? And this may be while they're in their practice training, because they'll have 2 6 months placement periods. This is where they can use PGDs and get those confidence and those skills. And I think it doesn't. And I think then we need to have with prescribers or looking at the medics model where they will put F1s and F2s with mentors together and this relationship of mentoring and make that a stronger body and union so that prescribers and people coming through the prescribing process are following more a more traditional path that the medics through their development and the GMC standards. But I think if we're going to change the idea with PGDs, I think we need to think about the person not coming out after 5 years worth of training and going flat out from day one. We need to think back and looking at the undergraduate syllabus, of course, on what can we do to influence that to ensure that we've got good quality independent prescribers coming out.
Okay, Derek, I'm gonna go to Farzana, but I think we should come back because my next question for everyone, and time is ticking on. Everyone's been very generous with their time. How do we transition to get these prescribers actually writing prescriptions and so on, and maybe moving away from PGDs, Farzana?
I just had a quick point to make. I saw Sid's point about where does the liability lie if a technician has provided a POM medicine under a PGD and the patients come to harm. But I suppose there were people who had the same sort of concerns when technicians first started taking on the ACT role. You know, if the wrong medicine goes out, who is liable? I think we're always going to have an argument with technicians taking on future roles, and we just can't let that hold us back as a profession. That was just my point.
I love your optimism. I think this is boiling down to, you know, where are we glass half full or glass half empty? You know, are we confident enough to give technicians that little bit of room? But the caveat with that is that pharmacists really need to do arguably what Derek's done, what Sid and you, Farzana, have done in terms of your practice. Derek, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was going to say, looking at the transition between transitioning, what we have to remember, I think, is here that when you do an IP course and you will do it in a defined area of competence. If we're going to put people into community pharmacy, they're not necessarily going to have one defined area. They're going to have to start bolting on other areas of competence skills to that same level. So we need to start developing the process, micro-credentialing, whether using therapeutic frameworks to get a wider experience of their specialist roles. And it may work towards the, I come back to using the medics model, that a GP medic is regarded as a specialist role, not just a specialist part of medicine, but GP practice is regarded as its own special, it has its own Royal College, for example. And we may be thinking now that community pharmacy is a specialism in its own right and a prescriber with inside it. I think Harry may have one or two comments he wants to add on that.
Yeah, Harry, couldn't agree more. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Derek. And what it has led to us is we've had the discussion. If you have a look at the GPHC's current consultation about prescribing and the element of that, they even recognise that themselves and say that this would include a generalism and an approach to common clinical conditions being one of the things that should be in the current prescribing course to allow you to do that. And I would encourage you all to reply to them and say, absolutely spot on, it's what we need. Because that, I couldn't agree more that it's what we're going to need in the community. Because looking at a single sector of practice isn't actually what we need in that sector. We need the specialism of generalism, generalism itself. So absolutely agree. And what we're currently doing isn't going to be what we're going to need going forward. Again, I suppose I'm more confident, would I say, with what we're doing here. Scotland's got the additional cost of teaching model, and we know we're already on a path that the students who are at Scottish universities are going to be exposed to the real life working environment. And as more and more prescribers come out, actually, their interaction is going to be with a prescriber. So you begin to see, again, it won't happen tomorrow, but if we look ahead, that model is in place. So it's really, really encouraging for me to see that these youngsters, the undergraduates you referred to, Derek, are going to be coming into an environment with prescribers in it and being given more access to it much earlier in their undergraduate course than my half day after 4 years when we got to a current GP college. So,
Derek.
I'm just taking forward. I'm going to keep the stone rolling on this particular point. This is my experience from working. I'm a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Glasgow and the Faculty of Travel Medicine, where there are 10 pharmacists registered with the faculty. There are around about 300 nurses. Of those 300 nurses, about 2-3% are independent prescribers. The rest are medics, usually working in academia and research. The majority of supply in a private, virtually non-NHS service in England and Wales, I know it's slightly different in Scotland, is run by nurses who are allowed, who run the service through PGD, but they're not independent prescribers. They can't make their own choices. They always have to refer it to a doctor or a GP or a medic. But pharmacists are recognised as an expanding group by the executive board of that faculty, and also internationally. We have to think now, working through FIP, and I work with groups in the States, that the International Society of Travel Medicine recognise that the fastest growing group of travel medicine practitioners our pharmacists globally. Yep. So I think if we get this right in the UK, I think we are showing ourselves up to the world through FIP and everywhere else. This is how it can be delivered. And bear in mind, we haven't got the problems of America and Canada with federalism and each state being different. Yes, we get around the laws and we manage the laws, but our NHS is the same. Virtually unilaterally with a few small changes.
Oh. Very good, Derek. Right, this conversation is becoming far too positive, so I'm gonna have to put a stop to that. I suppose to sort of final few points to finish and we can all go around again a few times if you like, but this is just me speaking to my experience, but my experience of going in, and trying to be an independent prescriber in community pharmacy, dead easy just to fall back on the PGDs, that's the point of this conversation. To quote now Alison Strath, it's like running with L plates on. I mean, that's quite a thing for the CPO to say, but I welcome it. I think it's great. It's great she said that, but what I'm not sure of as yet is maybe what we need to collectively discuss is and I mentioned the transition, but how do we get there? Like, because one of my, you know, being a prescriber is fine and everything's great and it's all very exciting and until it's not. And that's why what Sid said was so important. You know, the buck stops with you. If that 9-year-old that I'd given hydrocortisone had a very rare allergy to hydrocortisone, it could have been tricky enough, although it was clinically appropriate. But you see my point. I carry the can. There's no outsourcing of responsibility. I wonder what the group's view is on, I mean, Derek's touched on it a wee bit, like how we get there. Are community pharmacists, is it unfair to say we're maybe out of the way of training? Is there enough investment in training? Don't want to be negative or anything like that, but you know, we the pharmacist is the product, so you know we need to look after that, I guess. And how do we mitigate the risk when all these prescribers come out? Because you know, as I mentioned briefly earlier on, when I worked in general practice briefly, wonderful experience being, you know, enveloped in the multidisciplinary team and all the rest of it, but you know you could really go off on a flyer. And you know if you weren't a sort of procrastinating perfectionist like I think I am, then you know you could find yourself well off course doing some really quite risky stuff without the GPHC really knowing much about it. So I don't know, that's a lot of thoughts there, but I suppose it's around risk, how we get there, what needs to change in terms of infrastructure, is it culture? Happy to discuss. Farzana.
I would just love to see some sort of model that GPs currently get paid for when they are supervising and providing tutorials to GP trainees. So I'm always really impressed that your GP trainees come, they're fully qualified doctors, but they're doing their additional 3 years and they don't start to see patients by themselves straight away. And when they do start to see patients, they get a debrief after every patient to go over with their supervisor. It's really impressive. And just to have that level of peer review must give you so much more confidence with your own ability, but also you're able to take on feedback on where you could improve before you start running with caseloads of patients. And it's just a shame that community, pharmacy in general doesn't have that same sort of funding to provide that level of supervision. But certainly in community pharmacy going forward with having all these new IPs in 5-6 years time, where's their peer review? Where is their supervision going to be? Just to, while they expand their scope of practice and just being able to go to someone and have a little bit of a debrief.
Sid, you had your hand up there.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely agree what Fazana is saying as well. Especially when you're a prescriber, I think, especially a newly qualified prescriber, the most important thing to have is that support network as well. And if it's an area that you're out of scope with or you need someone to signpost, at least you know the team that you need to refer to are signpost. In terms of where we go next, I think, as you say, the elephant in the room is that funding issue as well. And I think what happens, how do we get there from the pharmacist, from student to prescriber? Again, there's not much detail yet from what I've seen about how the pharmacists are going to get the 90 hours supervision as well. And again, even if they do get that 90 hours supervision, are there that many clinicians that will be able to support all those thousands of pharmacy students in the UK? And what about the current pharmacists who are not prescribers that are wanting to become prescribers, and the main barrier is lack of DMP or DPPEs at the moment? And that's something that, you know, they will get annoyed that if a newly qualified pharmacist will be able to become prescriber and they're still struggling, and then the question is, how are they able to be have that supervision with a clinician within a 90-hour period, but they can't. So again, I do totally support having pharmacists become prescribers. Is that how we get there is the crucial part, especially now. And again, the details are a bit sketchy at the moment, so I'm also going to be looking for all these updates and as to how universities are going to be delivered that so that pharmacists will become safe and effective prescribers once they qualify.
Great points. Yeah. Harry, feel free.
Jonathan, I suppose I'm going to challenge your thinking on this. And for Zana and Sid have said, can I just check, does everybody here drive? Do you all drive?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And, you know, I'll use Alison's analogy of, you know, the L plates bit. See, when you passed your driving test, did you go and get a mentor that looked after you for the dangerous thing you'd just been given the keys to? No, I bet you didn't. And actually, it's one of the riskiest things that we can give you is a set of keys to a car. And you think, well, where are you going with that, Harry? I'm just challenging the thinking about what is the risk, because we're pharmacists and we're prescribers. Now, I'm not trying to belittle it. I'm just saying that actually we do riskier things in our life and just accept it.
Actually, when I bought my first car, I actually hired my instructor to sit in the car with me for a session or two so that I could take on knowing my car fully well and being confident with driving it. So, yeah, there was a bit of a mentorship there.
I don't disagree, but I bet you're the minority of 1 in 100,000. And I just think it's...
I'm going to challenge back a wee, not challenge back, I would never do that to you. To use Alison's analogy, to take that forward a bit. I don't think anybody on the call grew up in Northern Ireland, but I don't know if you're aware, but in Northern Ireland, when you pass your test, you have to stick an R plate on. So you go from L to R.
Yeah,
and in that first year, you have to stay under 45 miles an hour. Now, Northern Ireland only has about 30 miles of motorway, so that's it's not a problem. But I think it's a valid point, Harry. What really is the risk? How does the risk emerge? I see my view on it would be that in your professional career, you've got lots of Dunning-Kruger curves going on all at the same time. And you know, you can sign one curve off, but you might have 20 more going. You know, that's how prescribing feels in practice. I feel, I don't know how anybody else feels, but we've done a lot of work over the years on PIP with in the aviation scene and error management and checklists and all that kind of thing. And the comparison with aviation and risk is flawed in healthcare. There are downsides to comparison. However, one of the interesting ones is you're most risky not when you pass your pilot's license. I'm not sure of the actual number of hours, but it's around about 1,000 hours in. You're most likely to have your accident. And that speaks to that Dunning-Kruger curve. But I do take your point. We're probably to some degree being overcautious. And that speaks to Zubin Austin's work on what we're like as pharmacists, aren't we?
Yeah.
Can I just give a personal example, if that's okay? When I first qualified as an IP, I was feeling really confident about it because you've gone through, you know, a year and a half, lots of hours with supervision, et cetera, et cetera. I'd done all the additional NEST courses as well. But what's interesting is you don't know what you don't know when you do start prescribing, right? And if there's no one there to occasionally peer review some of the work you've undertaken, how do you know you have to improve your practice? And it's at that point, when I started getting feedback in general practice from when I started actively prescribing, I realized there was a lot more I still needed to learn. So it wasn't that I was prescribing unsafely, it's just that there was still more to do and I could always be better. So in community pharmacy, we just don't have that same sort of network. So Harry, I take your point. You don't need a mentor there to hold your hand once you qualify, you know, and they should be confident to go ahead and prescribing, especially in areas they feel confident. But at the same time, there should be some sort of process where they can occasionally be peer reviewed, even just a random couple of cases.
That's okay.
Absolutely. Sid, you had your hand up there.
Yeah, so in my local CCG area in Kent, if you are a non-medical prescriber, you have to fill in an annual sheet of areas that you're competent to prescribe in order of BNF chapter or the different clinical disease areas, as well as saying that you do have some element of clinical supervision from time to time as well, and go to any non-medical prescribing updates. And that's something that has to be filled in with your lead prescriber clinician, ideally a GP for the sector that I work in. And again, you could use something similar to that in a community pharmacy setting. For me, why I'm always talking about liability is because as a clinician, there's nothing worse than being someone who is unconsciously incompetent. And again, we get taught that through the ACP course as well, is not knowing that you don't know what you don't know unless you know, as someone there to double check that with you. And I think we're not there yet as pharmacists, but we can be. And I think as the more pharmacists become prescribers, become more and more experienced, definitely we'll get there. But it just, what we don't want to do is become sort of mavericks when we are initially when we become newly qualified as a prescriber.
Derek, thank you, sir.
I think we're partially there towards having this regulatory peer review because we're all pharmacists. Pre-COVID, how did we annually submit our registration? What was the process? Yes, I know it's been suspended for the last couple of years, but that was about having a peer review with a colleague who was necessarily working in that specialist area. So I think the structure is already there. The framework's already there. All we need to do is to give it a tweak.
Fair point. Harry, did you want to come in there? You're nodding.
No, I agree with Derek. And the thing is, that type of practice that Farzana and Sid's talking about is actually within their own control. That's not about... And the aspect as well, you know, saying that things and how you become more... You don't want mavericks, I think was what you said, sir. I can apply that to any part of our practice. We're focusing in on PGDs and it's moved to prescribing now. But I actually think that behavioural change is going to apply to any part of the practice. You could see it for counter prescribing, you can see it for management of the staff, whatever, it could all happen. And actually that's when we introduce, I'm afraid, the human psyche into this. That's when it becomes complex. And the aspect there, see when we're talking about the prescribers and how do we get them to do it, just giving them the qualification isn't going to do it. It's a bit like getting your driving license. That means you don't drive faster than 70 miles an hour on the motorway. You know, so does everyone stick to that? When you go for the behavioural change, we're going to have to accept that's going to take years.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. But once if we're moving in a stage beyond where we are just now, we will get there. Behavioural change is happening overnight.
Sorry, Harry. Thank you. First, did you have your hand up there?
Yeah, it was just to say, I think maybe Sid and I are being a little bit more cautious because of in the last few years, there's been a large number of pharmacists joining general practice. And as a result of that, there's more of us actively prescribing in general practice. There's been a couple of cases where real harm has been caused by a couple of practice-based pharmacists. And I think that's in general, we're just more cautious about making sure that there is a degree of supervision or peer review and really just working within your competence. Because I think certainly in England, there's been a large number of pharmacists joining PCNs, and some of them, I think, were asked to to take on minor ailment clinics, but they're not really the minor ailments that pharmacists are used to dealing with in the community, and they really weren't, you know, they weren't experienced enough and they weren't competent enough to be doing that, and that's where the harm came from. So I think that because of that, we're now a bit more used to having having a network, having a peer review, but also filling out those kind of forms that Sid was talking about and documenting quite clearly areas you can practice in. I do see what Harry's saying, that you can't always have the L plates on, and once you qualify, you have to be confident enough to go ahead and start practicing. It's just that I feel like we've got a long way to go for 5-6 years time.
And it's a scary place. For many, it's a scary place. And that is recognising it, but it can hold us back.
Nope. Sid?
I would say that pharmacists prescribe, it will become routine, it will become more commonplace. And again, the pharmacist would eventually will become more than capable, and we will really be having this discussion about safety concerns. I think it's because at the moment there was a couple of cases, as Fazan has mentioned, about pharmacist prescribers need to work in the sector and utilise it, and unfortunately caused patients harm. And whenever if it's a false prescriber making those type of harms to the patient, it will get picked up by the news, or we'll say as a profession that pharmacists are causing errors, causing patient harms. Are we like mandated to be like cheap GPs? But if it's a doctor doing the same type of thing as a false prescriber, the focus will be particularly on that GP rather than the doctors as a profession. So we're not still there yet as a pharmacist profession for the general public to be fully confident in. But I know we will get there, because, again, there's a lot of potential. And again, if we haven't seen that already during the pandemic, there's a lot of potential for community pharmacies to be offering prescribing and clinical services. And the need for healthcare is greater than ever before. So, again, it's just to reach to that point that Fazana has made, that while initially we're a bit of a cautious initially, but I do believe we'll definitely get over the hurdle. We just need to follow the process and do this properly without running straight away.
Thank you. For what it's worth, Sid, I totally agree. It's a progressive agenda. It's going to take time. Harry?
Just to say, Sid, I agree. I thought you put it really, really eloquently. And the element there as well is our other, let's call them a medical, our other prescribing colleagues at its widest probably don't get picked up as much, because you've got a pharmacy network helping prevent that harm getting to the rest of the population. So, you know, I don't think we should be too hard on ourselves, because I actually think we do a tremendous job of picking a lot of that up. And, you know, with the Swiss cheese analogy, one or two of them's going to get it through. And as pharmacy prescribes, I put my mortgage on it, that's going to harm. But, you know, it's about the minimisation of it. And I agree with you all about what we can do there. I think we've got to accept we'll never be 100%. We've got to be all the practices and all the processes and everything else that gets us as close to it as we can be.
But excellent. You know, listen, I think that's a really nice place to end it. Actually, I think so. We started off talking about have PGDs been holding us back, and I think we've let PGDs off the hook. We've not condemned them. You know, there will. Realistically, there's going to be a place for them, isn't there? We've all used them, we've all been glad to use them, probably. So long may they continue. Interesting footnote about pharmacy technicians, and does that create space for pharmacists to progress? I think that's a debate that needs to keep going. You know, are you glass half full or glass half empty? Let's have the debate. And yeah, moving into prescribing, you know, as Farzana says, Sid says, and Harry, well, all of you really, long way to go, but we can't turn back.
Sorry, Jonathan, I was just going to say, just quickly, just to round up my point, I found that by having experienced community pharmacists offer to maybe provide support, mentorship, or peer review those pharmacists that are starting off with providing Pharmacy First Plus, especially if they're still following the PGD and referring inappropriate to GPs when they should be prescribing. That I found it's something that I did suggest in practice, and it really helped. And that colleague I'm thinking of really now just stepped up and moved away from using the PGDs as a crutch. So I think that was the point I was making when I started bringing up the whole mentorship and networking.
I couldn't agree more with you, Farzana. I think, you know, like I will agree, in Scotland we're very lucky. I think I can't think of a better way to put it, but there's now a coalition of the willing emerging. And I think even the most, you know, commercially savvy contractors in the network up here recognize that their best product is the pharmacist. That's no longer, I don't think that's in doubt at all. And we are all pulling in the right direction. I think things like mentoring, I think all that infrastructure around, you know, getting pharmacists back into the way of training, you know, making that the norm, going well above what the GPHC requires in terms of demonstrating your competence in various areas. I think that's all coming. To be honest, I'm always an optimist, but I think the only question is how we get there, really, and who does what, and how well, in Scotland we've got a new CPO, so I guess it's around, you know, how Alison can engage with us all in different sectors, coalition of the willing, you know, give us all the time of day, and let's move forward and make it happen. You know, that's, couldn't be more positive. Listen, right, I will finish it because you know everyone has been really generous with their time. So Derek, Farzana, Harry, Sid, thank you so much. Really good chat. I love chats like this because it's like the progressive agenda. It's positive, and some you know, in other forums, some contentious issues broached in a very convivial way. So that's, you know, I always like to do that as well. So thank you very much for your time and your insights. It's been absolutely brilliant. And thank you for being part of our first ever conference as well, the Future Pharmacist Conference. Hopefully the first of many, fingers crossed. Goodbye for now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you all. Thanks.